get other things to float on the surface. So we did the next best thing, or rather, another best thing, which is to make something that is already made. I recommend this to any creative person in any discipline. If you're a painter, and you can't think of anything to paint, copy a landscape or a portrait by a painter you like. If you're a writer, and you feel like you're not capable of writing something new, find a poem you like and type it out again. If you're a chef, and you're drawing a blank in the kitchen, try to make a classic dish of your mentors. People with limited ideas of things call this cheating. It's not. It's inspired imitation. Making your own version of existing works keeps you on your toes. It keeps your machinery humming along. Take another one of the covers from that period. D'Angelo's version of the Prince song, She's Always in My Hair, which he contributed to the Scream 2 soundtrack. I know it well. I played on it. To make his version of She's Always in My Hair, D'Angelo had to find within himself a reason to make a version of She's Always in My Hair. The songs he picked weren't arbitrary. He wasn't turning in D'Angelo-style covers of Johnny Cash songs or the Banana Splits theme, though now that I say that, I want to hear both of those immediately. The songs he selected were songs that mattered to him and to the people around him, present company included. They were songs that were in him in some form already. If you x-rayed his creativity, you would see those songs in there, glowing in his bones. And by the time he was done with his versions, he had repossessed them to some degree. And even then, it wasn't straightforward. Even then, it wasn't simple. Even then, all the creative choices had to be identified, addressed, wrestled with, resolved. She's Always in My Hair is a perfect example. From the start, there was a question of how faithful to the original it should be. If I were making it on my own, I might have leaned in that direction. But when I'm working with D'Angelo, I filter in some of my own ideas and default to his creativity. I wasn't about to drag D'Angelo to hell with me and put him in the position where he was putting out a version that competed directly with the original. We ended up taking another approach, going away from the chilliness of the original towards something super funky. That decision had its own set of problems. What if we made it so funky that it was perceived as a way of showing up the original version? This may not have been a realistic fear, but it was an anxiety in my mind, a point of pressure. I've often thought about that period of D'Angelo's career, what it meant to him, how easily it was misunderstood as merely transitional, as the dead spot between point A, Brown Sugar, and point B, Voodoo. So here's my advice to anyone, in any field. When you feel like you can't make work from work that's already made. Don't duck and cover. Cover without ducking. Do it proudly. It keeps you active. A little bit after that, D'Angelo started working more diligently on the material that would become Voodoo. Those songs were a huge leap forward. They reminded people that he was a visionary, and then some. What accounts for the empty well suddenly being full again? In interviews, D'Angelo credited the birth of his son, Michael, and that may have been a big factor. But he also kept himself in shape, creatively speaking. Even when he wasn't creating, Voodoo wouldn't have happened without the period after Brown Sugar. Maybe that's self-evident. But it wouldn't have happened the way it did if he hadn't used the period after Brown Sugar the way he did. Thinking about She's Always in My Hair, returning to the choices we made during that period, also got me thinking. Deep down, I think that there are pure creatives and then there are privileged observers. In some way, I still think of myself as the lucky observer who gets to spend time near pure creatives to see them in action. When I hang with someone at that level, I'm amazed at their inability to act like a sponge or observe their surroundings. When I remember D'Angelo, that's what I think of. Or take Prince. I think of a typical late 90s night at Prince's house, where there was always a jam session with a bunch of younger musicians. Again, present company included. He might start with a riff to a cover song, and all of a sudden, we're launched into it. It happened one night with the Ohio Players, I Want to Be Free. The funny part was that Prince didn't even know the lyrics. That blew my mind. It kicked over my Jenga. How could that be? Why would he introduce such an iconic song if he didn't know it inside and out? It occurred to me that with Prince, maybe he feared being too derivative. As I discussed earlier, I don't really have that fear. I think my creative identity is unquestionably made up of parts of other people's creativity. I live my life being referential and reverential. But I've also seen cases where artists at an elevated altitude don't want to work that way. They hold the idea of covers at arm's length. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm not saying they're right. I'm saying that making things is about making choices. I, me, mimic. Copying or covering is always a valuable creative exercise. It gets you going. It restarts your brain and encourages you to look for the way that things are built. Listen to those last three sentences. The first two have lots of alliteration. Copying and covering. Gets and going. The third one doesn't have any at all. That's one thing to think about. But how does this work as an exercise? Not everyone is satisfied by replicating someone else's work. There's a related option, which is parody. In this day and age, parody is tricky. There are times when it seems like all of social media is just one giant parody factory. It's like that gum that Violet Beauregard demands in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Willy Wonka tells her that the lab is still working on it, but that the point of the gum is to taste like an entire three-course dinner. She starts chewing it against everyone's advice, and at first it seems like it's working. "It's amazing," she says. "It's made of tomato soup, roast beef, baked potato, and blueberry pie." It's that last part that doesn't work out so well. The blueberry taste is connected to some kind of blueberry deformation. She starts to swell and turn blue. Actually, it's more purple. She gets to be totally round. And then the Oompa Loompas come and take her away to the juicing room. They're going to squeeze all the blueberry juice out of her and try to get her back to normal. When I was little, that scene terrified me. I didn't like the idea of the juicing room. And that scene especially. Willy Wonka seemed like a psychopath. I don't even remember if they show her later on to assure us that Violet is okay. But as I've gotten older, I've thought about it a little differently. Willy Wonka was trying to make gum that was dinner. He was trying for a kind of cover version. But what he ended up with was gum that reminded people of parts of dinner with exaggeration that was funny and a little grotesque. What he ended up with was parody. And as I've gotten older, I've come more and more to see how important parody is as a creative exercise. Let's go back to She's Always in My Hair for a second. D'Angelo did a faithful version of it, but sometimes when I play Prince songs at home, on my iPhone, not on a keyboard or a guitar, I start imagining fake versions of them. Sometimes it's simple takeoffs on the lyrics, tweaks so simple that they wouldn't even have appealed to baby Weird Al Yankovic. That was my favorite Saturday morning cartoon for a little while. Baby Weird Al Yankovic. It doesn't matter to me that it never existed. Maybe she's always at the fair. That's stupid. But funny for a second. The whole family goes to convince her to come home, and she's not having any of it. She likes corn in the husk and the pig races, and she's going to stay there until she gets her fill. Or maybe she's always in the air, flying from place to place so often. And then she starts to be uneasy when she's back on the ground. Or maybe the thing that I parody isn't the lyrics. Maybe it's Prince's falsetto, where he holds a note, sweet and creamy, for like a full 3 seconds. And I imagine him doing it for like 30, 60. It's an impossibility, but it sounds funny in my head. Or maybe it's a guitar solo. I don't create these parodies, but I think about them. When I think about them, I am thinking about more than them, obviously. I'm thinking about new ideas, even though they are new ideas grown in the soil of old ones. Parody, even at this completely foolish low level, is a way of taking something that I love and trying to understand it. As you take the machine apart, you want to try to notice how it works. Are Prince's backup vocalists, who are usually Prince himself, multi-track, always echoing what he's about to sing? Or are they sometimes anticipating it? How many different guitar textures are there? Parody can be extremely analytical. But think of the nonsense lyrics, too. They are a way of making that work less intimidating. She's Always in My Hair is a great song, but it's not monumental. Other Prince songs from Little Red Corvette to Let's Go Crazy to a dozen more are monumental. If you parody them with nonsense, you make them approachable again. And if they were just ideas that a human being had, then maybe you can have them too. Mock them and liberate yourself. Note, I am not recommending releasing those parodies or making a career of them. You are not Weird Al. You are not even Baby Weird Al. But you can play around with someone else's creative work and free yourself up that way. There's an excellent, if strange, example from the world of food. When I was working on Something to Food About, I visited Nathan Myhrvold in Seattle at his Modernist Cuisine facility. I say facility because it's not just a kitchen. It's a warehouse and laboratory, and also possibly the future seat of world power. There are strange things there that I can't describe, or won't, for my own safety. But one thing I can mention is this dinosaur's tail that Nathan built to prove a pet theory of his own that dinosaurs flick their tails like bullwhips. Anyway, we ate there. And one of the things I noticed is that Nathan loves the idea of masquerade. At least three of the dishes pretended to be one thing, but were in fact something else. There was a pasta that turned out to be a gooey duck. There was a stick of benchaton, a hard charcoal, which he tapped on to show us how hard it was. And then he served it to us. But it wasn't that after all. It was pate. Then there was a quail egg that turned out to be mango and passion fruit. These were like magic tricks. They were illusions. That's one kind of creativity. Maybe the oldest, when art imitates life, but then throws a wrench into that process, thereby proving that it's not life at all. But the food that Nathan served was also kind of a parody. The thing that it looked like but wasn't communicated a set of expectations. That level of trickery seemed baked into the way that he worked. Nathan was already making delicious food, but he felt as though he wanted to increase the degree of difficulty by forcing another creative challenge upon himself. Not only should this taste good, but it needs to look like something else. When I started to ask around, I found that this was more common than I thought. The idea of laying ideas over ideas, especially if there was a joke loaded into the process. Often, that trickery took place at the end of the process. The original work was done, but packaging it created an opportunity for parodic treatment. I collected many examples of this principle while I was writing this book. But one of the best came from the music world, from the pub rocker Nick Lowe. I remember 1977 as the year that my dad listened to pop constantly in the car, such as Andy Gibb's I Just Want to Be Your Everything and The Emotions' Best of My Love. I was too young to see all the other things that were happening, punk records like the Sex Pistols' debut and the Ramones' Rocket to Russia, high modern classic rock like Pink Floyd's Animals, political reggae like Bob Marley's Exodus. It was also the year that David Bowie released the first record in his Berlin trilogy, Lowe. Nick Lowe took offense, not seriously, of course, at Bowie for using a misspelled version of his last name. So he did the same, releasing an EP called Bowie, B-O-W-I. The first time I heard that, it sounded silly, sure, and snotty, but also like one of the most purely creative things I've ever heard. He was turning tables that I didn't even know that were there. I thought about these kinds of tricks often during the writing and editing of my food book. The cover of that book is based on the artwork of Giuseppe Archimboldo, a 16th century artist who made portraits of people as assemblages of gourds or trees. When I first saw his paintings, Archimboldo reminded me of hip-hop. He was taking existing images and reordering them into something new. For the cover of that book, a version of the Archimboldo portrait was made of me. The act of making a food face for myself wasn't completely serious, in the sense that everyone knew that it was ridiculous, but it was completely serious as a creative act. The artist had to find shapes and textures and colors that match, and then had to assemble the thing so that it was a plausible photograph. In a sense, this was harder than Archimboldo, since he could paint a face made from food. For our book cover, we had to find food that looked like features. There's a radish in there, and a squash, and a donut for a bow tie. It's a parody of an existing style, Archimboldo's paintings, that gains meaning by also incorporating elements of another style, hip-hop sampling. The other example I ran across recently is Documentary Now, a show that was created by Fred Armisen and Bill Hader. Both of them were on Saturday Night Live. Fred played Prince, of course. And both have done excellent work outside of it. Bill's done voiceovers for Pixar movies and written for South Park. And Fred co-created Portlandia with Carrie Brownstein. The two of them love movies. And in particular, they love documentaries. What they decided to do was remake them. They did a version of Grey Gardens called Sandy Passage. They did a version of Nanook Revisited called Canuck Uncovered. They did a version of Thin Blue Line called The Eye Doesn't Lie. And they did a massive two-part takeoff of the massive two-part Eagles documentary, History of the Eagles, called Gentle and Soft, The Story of the Blue Jean Committee. When you're parodying a world, you need to pay attention to details. It teaches structure. It teaches rhythm. It teaches nuance. It also demands an incredible amount of specific technique. In the case of Gentle and Soft, Bill and Fred recorded an album for their fake band. When they did their takeoff of Grey Gardens, their directors, Rhys Thomas and Alexander Buono, used the same camera lenses as the original so that the movie looked the same. And in the parody of The Thin Blue Line, they shopped around for a courtroom artist to make their sketches look similar. As it turns out, it was the same exact guy. That's one of the coincidences that warms my heart. My final anecdote about copying and parodying goes back to the world of music and to an article that my co-writer Ben Greenman wrote for The New Yorker. There's a British band called The Wombles. That isn't exactly a band. They are costume characters from a kid's show, sort of an across-the-pond version of the Banana Splits. They came into existence back in 1973, which is right around when I came into existence. The main singer and songwriter from The Wombles was a man named Mike Batt, who went on to have a long career in the music industry. One of his other bands was a classical group called The Planets. And at the time, they had a track on an album called A 1 Minute Silence. The composition was only silence, just like John Cage's famous conceptual piece, 433. The only difference is that The Planets piece was, like the title says, a minute long. Bat credited to Bat/Cage. Though the Cage in his credit wasn't John Cage, it was Clint Cage, a pseudonym that he created just for the occasion of recording A 1 Minute Silence. John Cage's publisher, Peters Editions, wasn't amused. Peter sent a letter demanding that Bat pay royalties and saying that the idea of the silent song belonged to Cage. Bat didn't agree. He released his 1 Minute Silence as a single and went a step further, registering hundreds of other lengths of silent songs. If there's ever a Cage performance where they come in a second shorter or longer, he said, it's mine. I remember seeing the piece, the article, not Bat silent song, and laughing, because it was such a ridiculous idea. But I rethought it slightly. The dispute between Bat and Cage's publisher revolved around issues of copyright, but they are just as powerfully ideas of creativity. If you thought of something first, does that mean the same thought can't occur in someone else's mind with as much power and as much authenticity? If someone else thinks of something first, does that mean the same thought can't occur in your mind? And is it even the same idea if it grows in a different mind? These aren't new questions. People have asked them and answered them millions of times. But part of what creative people do is keep reopening them. Parody is new, but never new. It's funny, but it also tries to identify some serious issues. It's accessible because people have to get the joke, but it can't be too accessible. Or else you're settling for the worst jokes in the scary movie franchise. That means it requires exactly the same creative skills and sensitivities as making the original artworks. Physician, copy thyself. The example of Documentary Now raises a question that requires a little more consideration. Who should you copy? In that case, they're copying some of the best and most important documentaries in movie history. On the face of it, that makes sense. Why would you want to copy something terrible? But you should also copy yourself. This doesn't violate the rule, which is to remember to copy the best, because you are the best. In an earlier chapter, I explained that every creative person is ultimately his or her own judge, audience, and role model. You occupy these stations at different times in the process. But don't demean or diminish your own work when it comes time to practice parody. This sounds circular, but it's actually an arrow that stretches out into eternity. Let's go back to the example of D'Angelo and how he dealt with the creative paralysis that settled all around him after Brown Sugar. When he was blocked, he started copying existing songs. When he was unblocked, though, he didn't start basing his new music on influences that drifted in from the furthest reaches of left field. He was working off his own touchstones and keynotes. When he sat down to make a record, he was sitting down to make a D'Angelo record. There were glissandos he owned. There were vocal intervals he owned. Other people may have owned them also, or thought they did, but for his purposes, he was the sole proprietor. I have been lucky enough to meet George Clinton. At the Miami Book Fair in 2014, he and I did a joint interview on stage with Ben Greenman, who was also Mr. Clinton's co-writer. Ben knew that Mr. Clinton and I overlap in our careers, that we shared some of the same foundation. So he wrote some questions for Mr. Clinton and questions for me and then swapped them. He asked me about the importance of doo-wop, which I could easily answer since my father was a doo-wop singer. He asked Mr. Clinton about the evolution of hip-hop, which he could answer easily since his music provided the basis for much of West Coast G-Funk. It was an interview about creativity that was also itself creative. Afterward, we were hanging backstage, talking and taking pictures, and Mr. Clinton mentioned something about his creative process. My ears went up like a dog who hears the food dish rattling. I know when a genius is in the room and talking. He said that one of his methods has always been to revisit his old work, without reservation, without fear, without shame. His doo-wop group, The Parliaments, had its first big hit with I Want to Testify in the late 60s, after years of working the seams of Detroit soul. A few years later, because of the flowering of the psychedelic era, The Parliaments had morphed into a pair of bands, Parliament, a kind of pop soul outfit, and Funkadelic, a so far out you can see in the Black Rock concern. Both of those bands reused Clinton's early compositions. Parliament would go on to re-record Testify for its own Up for the Downstroke album, and Funkadelic's debut contained reworkings of I'll Bet Ya and Good Old Music. Partly, Clinton wanted these songs to get a hearing now that his platform was bigger. But it was also a creative method, as he kept proving in his career and his life. In the mid-90s, during one of the golden ages of hip-hop, Parliament Funkadelic released an album called Dope Dogs. It was a concept record about a drug-sniffing dog that incorporated commentary about addiction, identity, lust, and the hypocrisies of the federal drug policy. Clinton produced that record himself with a technique that was both retro and groundbreaking. He explained in his memoir, "Brothers be, yo, like George, ain't that funkin' kinda hard on you?" I had listened to lots of hip-hop by that point, and certain styles in particular impressed me. I loved the Bomb Squad and the work that they were doing with Public Enemy, so I started to do my own version of the same thing, sampling older P-Funk records. I tried not to use the obvious samples. Other people had in mind the aura right out of them, so for the most part, I drew from the outtakes, rarities, or live tracks. I produced that album myself, in the most labor-intensive way possible. I took a loop of 3 or 4 seconds and ran it from the beginning of the song to the end, after which I muted the parts of the loop I didn't want to use. Clinton knew that there was more sophisticated technology available to him, but he didn't want to use it. It didn't fit his metaphor, which was gene splicing. He had been playing with the idea since the mid-70s on the clones of Dr. Funkenstein, and here he played with it again. There was a quality present in every single second of P-Funk music, and if you moved it to another compositional body, it remained. You could snip a hair, a metaphorical hair, so a note or a phrase, and still identify it as P-Funk. He had already created, and he used these creations to make new ones. Sometimes, though, George didn't even use pieces of old songs. He used old pieces that never found their way into songs. Maybe in 1974, Bootsy Collins had played a bass part for Ride On that was abandoned as the song evolved. Maybe in 1977, Juni Morrison had come up with a keyboard squiggle that couldn't find a home in Groove Allegiance. George called these pieces of music seeds and stems. The idea was that when the smoking was done, those were the leavings at the bottom of the bag. They weren't the real dope, but they were from the same plant. George figured that he might as well get used from them. He might as well grow new songs from them. I urge everybody to revisit their earlier work. I know a lot of actors who say they never watch themselves in movies. I know a lot of authors that say they never reread their books. I don't understand that. I can understand not sitting in a penthouse repeating your own lyrics to yourself over and over. I can understand not being slouched on a couch in front of a huge TV watching yourself on screen. But I think you have to go back and look at your own work with a clear eye, and hopefully with pleasure. It should keep you feeling good about yourself to know that you completed projects in the past. I was talking to the New York-based portrait painter, Kayende Wally, at one of my food salons. He said that he would sometimes walk by one of his paintings and just have a flash of appreciation, not in an egotistical way, but he would see the size of it and the complexity of it and remember not just the work that went into it, but the fact that he had survived that work and lived another day to make another thing. In the last year, Tariq and I followed a similar philosophy. As we started getting ready for the next Roots album, titled Endgame, should be out in 2018, or 19, or 20. We made a conscious decision to take half a step back and listen to our own body of work at a slight remove. Listen to our records the way that a younger artist like Thundercat or Kamasi Washington might listen to them. We would be Roots fans, and we would make a record in that spirit. Luckily, we had everything. The whole photo album, musically speaking, was available. This was one of the most important principles. Don't throw anything away. Technology today makes it easy to keep your old ideas at your fingertips. The half-baked ones, the ones that seem to peter out, you'll be able to go back to them, and you should. There is no such thing as garbage. One of my favorite restaurants to visit is Next in Chicago. I developed a relationship with Dave Barron, the chef there. Once Dave told me that he wanted me to try a new dish, I was excited. He came out with a plate that looked like what you see in a Warner Brothers cartoon to communicate the idea of trash. A fish carcass, mostly stripped to the skeleton except for the eyes staring outward, a clump of garbage next to it, and a piece of what looked like broken glass. It had everything but a fly buzzing around with stink lines. "Try it," Dave said. He was deadpan. I did. And it was one of the most delicious things I had ever eaten. No such thing as garbage. When you are recycling parts of past works, be smart about it. Recognize that there was a reason the idea didn't pop the first time around. Maybe the time wasn't right. Maybe the context for it didn't yet exist. But also realize that many ideas flower eventually. This loops back into the idea of parody. If you reuse your own old ideas, you shouldn't always be so stone-faced about it. You can approach it, at least initially, as a kind of self-parody. George Clinton didn't suffer from block like D'Angelo. He's never been blocked in exactly that way, as far as I can tell. Just take a gander at his discography. But he must have felt pressure to live up to his old works. When you achieve a certain amount in this or any other business, getting crushed by expectation is inevitable. Whenever I look at Pitchfork and see that a band has a new album, I'm always on the alert for this kind of sentence. This work represents an advance over the last one in this way. It's usually there, but is it usually true? Why is every new work an advance? Is that just how time works? I think it's part of the creative psychology. No one wants to do worse than they did the last time out. No one wants to be the one who accuses someone else of it, and yet, we're at the mercy of our past work. Generally, be willing to be lighter. The consequential work, the work that eventually ends up weighing something, isn't always undertaking with such paralyzing seriousness. sample sale. The George Clinton examples demonstrate how important creativity is to hip-hop, or maybe how important hip-hop is to creativity. Throughout this book, I've been making an effort to branch out and look at a broad set of disciplines, at other kinds of music, but also at cooking and comedy and painting. But I want to come back to hip-hop for a little while. I want to think of it in light of all the things we've been talking about. Stealing from others, stealing from yourself, making the old new, and discovering ways to jumpstart and sustain your creativity through all these behaviors. The earliest hip-hop singles like Rapper's Delight and The Breaks used studio bands, though those bands were just recreating music from existing records. Then hip-hop entered an era of sampling. Technology made it possible, and aesthetics followed technology. For a little while there, most bands bit pieces of existing songs, both melodic and rhythmic, and arranged them into sonic beds over which MCs would rap. It was simple at first, and then in the hands of masters like the Bomb Squad, it became elevated into high art. There's a moment on Rebel Without a Pause, where they take a second of Clayton Chicken Gunnell's screeching trumpet. Clayton was in the JBs, James Brown's backing band. In its day, it was a kind of imitation of the far-out sounds of John Coltrane. It was a funk appropriation of the liberating principles of the headiest jazz. But then the Bomb Squad found it and gave it to Public Enemy, and it became something else all over again, a warning, a call to arms. I could write a whole book on the supreme creativity of the Bomb Squad. Maybe I will. Until then, I'll mention them whenever I feel like it in the books I write. They were able to take existing materials and make something bracing and new from them. You might think that a definition of pure creativity includes the idea of creating something from nothing, but that's also a little bit of dodge. Nothing is nothing, really. That seems like a paradox, but what I mean is that when a saxophonist plays a note, he's using an instrument manufactured by Selmer or Yamaha or Kylewirth. Which manufacturer depends on level of experience and price range and lots of other factors, but the noise comes from somewhere. The same is true, and maybe more true, of filmmakers, the cameras, the lights, the film. Most directors don't fabricate those things by hand. But wait, people say, those are only the tools. That's only the hardware. The creative person writes all the software. When that sax makes a sound, that's a sound that comes straight from the player's heart and soul. This is even less true. There are notes. There are scales. The most experimental jazz player still has to reckon with them, partly because the destination of that sound is yet another piece of equipment that came pre-designed, the human ear. This is a little far afield. The point is that creativity has ideas, but it also has materials. And the Bomb Squad's materials happen to be certain pieces of technology, samplers and sequencers, and a world of recorded music that they could feed to that technology. They didn't play any instruments, but that meant that they played every instrument. The Bomb Squad perfected a certain kind of sound bit. Their production on the Young Black Teenagers' debut album, a white group discovered and nurtured by Hank Shockley, and supported by Public Enemy, remains one of the crowning achievements of production in any era. It's George Martin level, Brian Wilson level. It'll blow your mind out when you start to see how they assembled the bricks. That came out in 1991. The same year, there was another release that completely turned my sense of the genre on its ear. Since 1989, MTV had been broadcasting a show called Unplugged, where bands went on stage and played stripped-down versions of their hits. It was a way for rock artists and sometimes pop groups to show that they had real chops and that their songs had real structure. The series started with acts that were naturals for the treatment. Squeeze did the first episode. Graham Parker did the second one. And they started to branch out a bit. I remember the Hall & Oates episode in 1990 because they were Philly superstars. Because when I heard about it, I imagined exactly what it would be. The leanness of the melodies and syncopated rhythms preserved. And Daryl and John getting back to their roots as basically white soul singers. Then in 1991, the series tried an experiment. The first stretch of the season included a bunch of usual suspects. Sting, R.E.M., Paul McCartney. On April 10th, though, at Chelsea Studio, the show sampled a number of hip-hop acts, including MC Light, De La Soul, and A Tribe Called Quest. They set about performing their hip-hop material in an acoustic setting. There was political capital invested in this. Of course, this was in the middle of a period in which much of white America, including music stars who should have known better, dismissed hip-hop as something less than music. But there was also a creative dimension, which let the artists rethink their songs in this new acoustic setting. All the acts performed on the bill admirably, but the undisputed star of the show was LL Cool J. His set was beyond amazing. It was transformative. For starters, there was the way that LL looked. He dominated the stage, ripping through performances of songs like Jinglin' Baby, and especially Mama Said Knock You Out. White deodorant, clearly visible. The audio was as exciting as the visual. Under the music direction of guitarist Mike Tyler, whose band, the Philly Outfit Pops Cool Love, backed LL for the show, the songs were reborn and renewed, recreating the riff of Mama Said Knock You Out. Rather than playing the original Sly and the Family Stone sample, made it somehow more organic, earthier, and almost folk music. That was obviously the touchstone for The Roots when we backed Jay-Z on his Unplugged performance in 2001. But I also think that the Unplugged hip-hop game is a uniquely effective way of flexing creative muscles, of taking songs that were already Frankenstein's monsters and giving them another shot of electricity. That original LL Cool J performance has stuck with me in important ways over the decades. When I think about its effect, I think I can distill it down to one short, sharp piece of advice. Change your materials. I know writers who mostly write on their laptops. Maybe that's every writer now. And when they switch to longhand or an old typewriter or a tablet with some weird Bluetooth keyboard, they enter a new creative phase. It's not just that they get a new perspective on their own work. They actually have to adjust their creative habits. Maybe things that were easy before, like spelling, say, which was corrected by the computer, become more difficult and require more of their attention. But maybe things that were hard before, like setting aside a page when it's filled with words and moving on to the next page, become easier. Material changes matter because they change the process of creative production. On The Tonight Show, Jimmy Fallon and The Roots have this recurring bit where we accompany singers on classroom instruments. Recorders, xylophones, woodblocks. We done it with Mariah Carey on All I Want for Christmas Is You. We done it with Adele on Hello. We done it with Idina Menzel on Let It Go. When we play those songs, it makes them fun and approachable. Big stars somehow become more human-sized. But it also forces us to recreate these polished manicure ballads in more modest and rough-hewn conditions. And that means creating them again. All I Want for Christmas Is You on classroom instruments isn't the same song as All I Want for Christmas Is You on the most expensive professional instruments. This is why D'Angelo keeps his studio setup anchored in 1997 technology and feel. It maintains the purity. It doesn't corrupt the process with modernization. There's no trivial future to chase. Look over there. The modern world is an improvement over the other eras in many ways. We have smartphones and smart houses. We have top-of-the-line scripted TV. But in other ways, it's a problem. More than ever before, we're distracted. My life is incredibly packed and overprogrammed. I work at The Tonight Show and make albums with my band, and produce other artists, and teach a college class, and produce television and film, and occasionally do audiobooks. I don't have much time to be distracted, but I feel the pull of it all the time. Now, 15 years ago, I didn't have a little hum at the base of my skull reminding me to check email or Twitter or read the latest gossip about the celebrity couple at the moment. Are they really in love? Is it just a publicity stunt? The problem is trivial, of course. But for creative people, it's also consequential. The one thing you can say about creative work is that it requires your time and effort. More than ever, these days, that's difficult to guarantee. The very same tools that let you work so efficiently, word processing, Wikipedia, are connected to other tools that rob you of your efficiency and focus. They don't destroy your will to live, but they do destroy your ability to live in the moment. All right, check it. Here's an example with Homer Simpson. Homer Simpson. Wait, I'm confused about the movie. So the cops knew that the internal affairs were setting them up? Man 1. What are you talking about? There's nothing like that in there. Homer. Oh, you see, when I get bored, I make up my own movie. I have a very short attention span. Man 2. But your point is very simple. You see, when Homer. Oh, look, a bird. Homer runs away giggling. Okay, I do a bad Homer, but you get the point. We think, or we tend to think, that creativity is the enemy of distraction. Or at least some of us think that. Charles and Ray Ames certainly did. In the middle of the 20th century, the Ameses were one of America's premier creative forces. They were a husband and wife team, by the way, not brothers. Ray was a woman. You may already know that, but if you do, you're in the minority. I can't tell you how many fancy events I've been at, including some from the design and art world, where people say, the Eames brothers, like they're the Wright brothers or the Chambers brothers. The Eameses designed the Eames chair, but also made the famous film Powers of Ten. And the Eameses didn't like having music in their office. They thought that it distracted their employees. They didn't like having the idea of music around, really. It led to humming and whistling, also massive distractions. Charles said that to him it was like chewing gum. But they also recognized the human need for organized sound. They designed a sound tower. It was kind of a Rube Goldberg contraption. You dropped a marble down it, and as gravity rolled it along its track, the marble struck different tiles and produced different sounds. They commissioned a piece by composer Elmer Bernstein. In theory, the tiles could be swapped out to create a new piece. It worked in their office to create background music, but also to eliminate distractions. They thought they could program music that contributed to concentration rather than disrupting it. It showed creativity in producing sounds that, in other forms, they thought undermined creativity. That's how the Eameses solved things. A Swiss design publication asked me to rethink the design and composition of the Eames Tower. I thought about the Lazy Susans I had made for my food salons and sold in a small shop in Soho. Large Corian spinning discs that were designed using strobe disc patterns, and how I imagined that one day there would be a second generation of them that actually function as music-making devices as well as art objects. I had imagined actually putting the Lazy Susans up on the wall and using their rotational speed to create a beat. That hadn't happened yet. But the Eames Tower project gave me a chance to do something similar. I worked with designers and created an updated version of the tower. My version is actually two towers. The reasons have to do with the way that hip-hop works at its foundation. In its early days, it took existing songs and used them as the foundation for new songs. I thought the best way to duplicate the DNA of hip-hop was to build not one, but two towers. And to let the users mix and match the way that hip-hop producers mix and match samples into a new song. The way that DJs mix and match turntables. I thought the best way to make music, hip-hop music specifically, was doubling the Eames equation and placing a rhythm tower next to a melody tower. I chose the song I wanted to recreate. It seemed difficult to think of at first, but then it seemed obvious. Good Times by Chic. The song was a major hit in the disco era, but also became the foundation for one of the first hip-hop anthems. The bass line of Good Times, played by Bernard Edwards, was the basis for the first huge rap song, Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight. After that, it has reappeared in dozens of hip-hop songs over the years, sometimes in the same form, sometimes in slightly altered form. I wanted to let one tower stand in for the basic Chic sample and let the other tower add accents that would call to mind some of the many songs that use Good Times as their basic sample. Not only Rapper's Delight, but also the Beastie Boys' Triple Trouble, Queen's Another One Bites the Dust, Blondie's Rapture, and Vaughn Mason and Crew's Bounce, Rock, Skate, Roll. Good Times is one tower, because it's a towering achievement. The other tower permits variation. You can see both from anywhere in the office, or you can see one from the other. They are towers, but They're also pillars. They are structures, but also foundations. They are building blocks in the same sense as DNA. All life, all music, all creativity comes from those same basic ingredients. The towers, in the end, were lesser in production and assembly and mixing and matching and fun. They both produced and represented creativity. Most important, they fought boredom without creating distraction. In the same way that the original Eames Tower did. At least that was the theory. If you were sitting in your office and you heard the plink of a vertical xylophone, you might find it pleasantly diverting. And at least you wouldn't be making that infernal whistling noise. But they also provided an object lesson in the way early hip-hop was created. Finally, they worked as a kind of metaphor for distraction and how it didn't have to defeat creativity. When those early hip-hop artists were sitting around in their garages or their bedrooms, burning with the desire to make something, and they heard Good Times on the radio, they didn't resent Chic. They didn't worry about time spent listening was somehow detracting from their own creativity. Instead, they heard the song and decided to use it to make it their own. They reinvested what they heard in a new artwork. The process began to pay dividends almost immediately. The Two Towers recreated that process of creation. There was no such thing as distraction. There was only traction. When I was in D.C. at the Kennedy Center being interviewed by Eric Diggins, he asked me an interesting question about the difference between musicianship and musicality. In his view, one was chops, and the other was the ability to access that ability. I thought it was worth submitting that to a little class history. In the 50s, families of color started fleeing from down south and went to industrial places, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana. Families got these well-paying jobs that allowed them to purchase houses with garages, and they had extra income for instruments. That helped bring bands into existence. Funk sprung up in Dayton, Ohio, but soon enough, factories shut down, and there were foreclosures. There was no room for the music room. If you were born after that, the circumstances were different. You had to find your way to music. Grandmaster Flash desperately wanted to play instruments, but he couldn't do it. He couldn't make much noise in the projects. We have just discussed how creativity can come from distraction. How can be an outgrowth of the process of recognizing which things are taking your eye off the ball. That was what brought the Eames Tower to life. But the distractions can work differently. They could be a matter of seeing the whole world around you, then using this power, this energy, to identify a new particle, a new spark. That's another thing that creativity is, taking the existing world and making something new from it. Andy Warhol was able to take pre-existing logos and icons and recontextualize them. Jagger and Richards were able to do the same with blues. Hip-hop artists were able to see the world not as a familiar set of limits, but as an exciting spray of possibilities. Eames Dimitrios, the grandson of Charles Eames and the son of Charles's daughter, Lucia, defined creativity for me in a way that harmonizes with this idea. Somewhere at its heart, he wrote in the email, creativity is the ability to see something else. In the end, everybody looks essentially at the same words, notes, colors, problems, answers, numbers, cities, people. All, or at least meaningful subsets of each, are in some sense available to us all. But creativity has to do with how you arrange and construct what you pull out of those familiars. I would add to that that it has to do with how you pull yourself out of those familiars, which Eames gets to in the second part of his definition. The astronomer and cosmologist Vera Rubin, who found 90% of the matter in the universe, often said that the role of the observer was to confound the theorist. I think creativity, in a sense, is confounding yourself in both roles as if in an endless chase. When you are satisfied with what you have imagined, you confound it with new patterns you see. And then when you are pleased with that, you conjure up an impossibility, which, in turn, will be challenged by your new perceptions, always surrendering to the journey. You lock into what is there. You see things others do not. You create, you distract, and disrupt yourself with what is not there, and you start the process all over again. It's a cycle. Specifically, it's a life cycle. distraction, and traction. Every creative pursuit has its own kind of distraction. I've said several times that where I work is almost as important to me as what I'm doing, and that the move to late night, and then the Tonight Show, was important to the Roots because it gave us back a small, scrubby practice room that we could use as a recording studio and took us away from the increasingly cushy, increasingly fancy studios where major labels try to stash their acts. The smaller, sparser room created a feeling of leanness and also minimized distraction. It didn't eliminate it. Of course, Kirk might have a question, and Mark might make a joke, and someone else, I won't say who, might have had their head turned by something on Twitter or Instagram. But at least the distractions are happening within the space rather than happening as a part of the fundamental character of the space. But there's also another kind of distraction that I've had to endure away from the band on my own. I remember when I was working on Mometa Blues. There were days when I would wake up, start a document called Today's Book Thoughts, and then a cloud of nothing would settle. 10 minutes would pass. 20 minutes would pass. I couldn't write a word. And that was a book where what I was mainly doing was relating the circumstances of my own life. Well, it wasn't really a cloud of nothing. It was a cloud of distraction. I had, all around me, the internet. With just a single mouse click, I could listen to an entire Outkast demo or read about the zoning in Philadelphia. Or hop back in time and find a vintage interview with Wilson Pickett. The one I liked was from the mid-80s, when he was performing in the kind of package shows that my parents played when I was a kid, a group of artists banding together to bring back audiences from the past. His was called Night of the Living Legends, and he was on the bill with Lloyd Price and James Brown. James Brown wasn't up for doing any press, but Pickett and Price went on TV with Bill Boggs, a New York area TV host. They reminisced about the old days, about the Chitlin Circuit, about Soul Superstar. They compared their package tour with Michael Jackson, who was at that time the biggest star in the world. Michael could draw a crowd of 100,000 in a night, they said, while they could draw 10,000 a night, 7 nights a week. Either way, it added up. His math was a little suspect, because Michael could have played the same crowd of 100,000 every night. But I knew what he meant. There was more than one way to skin a cat. Why did I bring this interview up? Distraction. But it was for more than giving you an example of my own distraction. One of the things that Wilson Pickett said had stuck with me. He was long past his prime as a commercial force. There wouldn't be another Mustang Sally or Land of 1,000 Dances or Beachwood 6345789. But he was eager to get back onto the air. He told Bill Boggs that all was a matter of material. At his height, he could command the best songwriters. He fully understood the kind of songs that were hitting the charts, because the songs that hit the charts were Wilson Pickett songs. He was a pace car. People said, "Go get me a song that sounds like Wilson Pickett." More to the point, he wrote some of those songs. He created songs whether or not he was a songwriter. What he did to Land of 1,000 Dances was different from what Chris Kenner had done. It was unquestionably creative, but he also wrote some of his biggest hits. He wrote Mustang Sally. He wrote 99½ Won't Do. He wrote I Found a Love. By the time of the mid-80s interview, he was more tentative both about finding songs that were right for him and about writing his own. He said he was playing shows all around Europe, making a living, but that when it came to getting back into the studio, he didn't know what to record. He was a dynamo still, a powerful man with a powerful voice, but he couldn't lock in. He couldn't get what we called traction. I imagine him sitting around backstage and feeling kind of a numbness that he wasn't connecting with the songs people were sending him. What was he supposed to do instead? Read history books? Go for long walks. He was a singer. He was designed to sing songs that he was designed to sing, if that's not too circular. In their absence, he seemed frustrated and uneasy. At one point, Pickett said something optimistic to Bill Boggs. He said that he was hopeful that he could find his way back into the studio. when I was trying to write Mometa Blues, and instead of finding my way into the Wilson Pickett interview, I thought about that simple idea, getting back into something, and how what I was dealing with was almost the opposite. I was always in the internet. I was always in the middle of all those mouse clicks. What I had to learn was how to get out of something before I got back into anything else. Because of everything that technology has given us, it prevents us from seeing that the Wilson Pickett feeling, that nervous sense of creative disengagement, that restlessness where you can't locate any new ideas within yourself is still everywhere. But that emptiness is now cluttered and crowded. I remember a passage once from a pulp mystery novel where a character said he had emptied a liquor bottle and now felt just as empty as that bottle. That's sometimes the exact effect of darting around the internet. You are into everything, but you're into nothing. I have started trying an exercise to help myself untangle this knot. When I find myself going to more than one site in rapid succession, when I'm nervously bouncing from that Bill Box interview to the Outcast demo to a commercial for European telecom providers that I find funny because it includes a little bit of music that sounds like Yola Tingle's cover of the Parliament's I Can Feel the Ice Melting, then I stop. I shut the computer. Or at least, I shut my eyes for a second so that I can't feel the computer. I let the distraction become boredom. And when the distraction shifts into boredom, that's the seed of something creative. On the face of it, that doesn't make sense. Boredom seems like the least creative feeling. It seems like numbness. But it's actually a way of clearing space for a new idea to spring back up. The poet Joseph Brodsky has a famous essay about boredom, where he urges students, I think it was a commencement address, to embrace it. When hit by boredom, go for it. Let yourself be crushed by it. Submerge, hit bottom. In general, with things unpleasant, the rule is, the sooner you hit bottom, the faster you surface. The idea here, to paraphrase another great poet of the English language, is to exact full look at the worst. The reason boredom deserves such scrutiny is that it represents pure, undiluted time and all its repetitive, redundant, monotonous splendor. Brodsky goes on to say that the point of learning about time is that it reminds us of our total insignificance. He is speaking to college students who are convinced of their own significance. They are big in their own minds. He wants to reverse that, wants them to realize that they are nothing. They are dust in the wind. That seems a little bleak and mean to tell kids. Aren't we supposed to be propping them up and encouraging them to have their own ideas? Forget about kids, even. Isn't that what this whole book is about? To remind people that they're not nothing? That they are something, and they can make more things? But Brodsky has a trick up his sleeve. He says that when you realize you're insignificant, you can start feeling two things, passion and pain. Passion is the way you fight meaninglessness. If you were significant, you wouldn't necessarily need passion at all. You could just sit back and experience things as they come. And pain is the acceptance of the truth of that insignificance. Boredom, that sense of being disconnected, is what makes you bounce back with renewed commitment. That's what Brodsky was saying about Wilson Pickett, even though he wasn't talking about Wilson Pickett at all. Let yourself go to the sense of being disconnected and meaningless. Let it wash over you and drown you a little bit before you come up gasping for air. Creativity is a fight against that insignificance. That's all good advice, along with being very high-end philosophical thinking. The only thing I can add to it is that you kids who are growing up in the grip of the internet have to approach it a little differently. Boredom for all of you now is about putting down the phone and letting a little silence into your day. It's about not being so compulsive about listening and watching and participating. It's about hanging back and then extending yourself into the space that's created. I remember being in Hawaii, staying at the house of Shep Gordon, the legendary music manager, and having an extended period of just unhooking all the technology that usually connects me to the world. It was terrifying at first, but then it was elevating.